Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But, you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. I'm Delcherie Gladden. I'm a journalist, an editor, and USA Today bestselling author of over 30 published novels. And on this week's episode, I have Charlene Dietz, and she's going to be talking about one of her books called The Flapper, The Scientist, and The Saboteur. Charlene, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you for inviting me on. I started writing probably in about 2008. And it took me 10 years to get my first book published. I had a lot of editors and a lot of advice, and I did a lot of revisions. And finally, the book came out and was published. And since then, I've written three other books, and I'm starting on a fourth one, which will be a trilogy. The first three books are my Flapper series, The Flapper, The Scientist, and The Saboteur, The Flapper, The Imposter, and The Stalker, The Science. Just the psychic and the nut. And then I became diverse a little bit and did a historical biography about a spinster that lived in 1634, and her life was pretty incredible. And that was a pretty incredible experience for me. I'd never planned to be a writer. I thought I would be, after I retired from education, I would just paint and draw and sculpt and take life easy and enjoy nature. But I had stories to tell, which I didn't realize were really important to me.
That's neat. So you hadn't been writing on the side during your career in education.
Well, now I have to back up and say, yes, I did. I joined Southwest Writers back in the 90s, and I wrote some short stories, and they won awards. Oh, well, this is pretty easy. Yeah, I'd put them out a couple of nights and then send them off or enter them. But I never really thought about being a writer or a published author. Never thought about sending my short stories off to be published. But evidently, it came rather easily to me. And it was fun. And it was a good stress reliever.
Absolutely. That's how I feel about writing, too. Sometimes it's hard to write when I'm too stressed out. But when I can find something that works with whatever's going on at the time to just get my mind off of the everyday stuff and escape into a different world for a little bit, it's great therapy.
I've used it frequently when I started writing my novels, when I'd get to a point where I just wasn't too sure where I was going to go with it or what my characters wanted me to do because they were misbehaving all over the place. I would go for a long walk, and then all of a sudden a short story would pop into my head, and I think, well, I'll just spend an evening or two writing that. And then for some reason, I get right back on track with my novel. It was really nice because I can say I really never, ever have had writer's block. I've just had divergent techniques.
For me, I've never really been a short form writer outside of like journalism stuff. That's something that I struggle with more, trying to create a whole story in just, you know, a few pages, really. And I tend to jump from novel project to novel project, and that can get hard to finish things sometimes. So I like that you take a step away and work on a short project. Maybe that is something I should try.
You know, as a journalist, I think I can't imagine that wouldn't be really easy for you. I have such admiration for journalists because the stories that you have, I'm sure, are just waiting to be made into fiction, I would imagine. But I'm thinking, do you write several novels at a time? Do you have several going at a time?
Usually, yeah. Anywhere from 3 to 5, usually.
Oh, my goodness.
Which makes it tough to finish a series occasionally.
And you write many different genres.
I do. Yeah. I write probably 4 or 5 different genres. I'm not very good at staying focused on one one project at a time, or I don't know how a lot of writers write in one genre, and that's where they find their groove and they stick with that. And I admire that because I'm like, ooh, I got another idea for this. I'm going to just start writing something completely different in a genre I've never done before. And it's usually fun and I learn a lot doing that. But yeah, I do have several unfinished series that I really need to get back to at some point and wrap them up for readers.
Well, I totally understand that thinking completely. You don't need short stories. You just keep on doing your multi-novels. Wow. I usually have two going at once, but you're right. Doing the same genre over and over and over again, I needed to branch out, and that's why I did the historical biography.
And that one sounds really interesting. I read just like the synopsis about it. Was this someone that you just came across and were intrigued by and wanted to learn more about?
Yeah, I was doing genealogy, and I came across a passage that went something like, in 1634, gentleman Giles Brandt, aged about 39, married a 9-year-old Indian princess in the pre-colonial territory of Maryland. And I thought, what? A 9-year-old Indian princess? This work. I was totally captivated, so I had to read more. And this is just doing genealogy. Went on, it said, Governor Leonard Calvert of pre-colonial Maryland and his good friend, spinster Lady Margaret Brandt, Giles Brandt's sister, are the guardians of the 9-year-old Indian princess. Wait a minute. There are too many red flags waving here. First of all, why would the governor, who's the most powerful man in the territory, which was totally male-dominated, have a spinster for a good friend? That doesn't make any sense. And why would these two allow such an inappropriate marriage? And what is this inappropriate marriage about? And so I thought, drop genealogy. I don't care about that. I'm after the story.
Yeah,
so that's how that started.
That is definitely something that will stop you in your tracks and be like, wait, what happened there? I can't imagine that ever being in an appropriate situation that you'd be like, yeah, it makes sense. How bizarre.
Well, the problem is when people are researching and nobody has left any primary source materials, as Margaret Brandt did not. The only primary source material she left was her will, and you know how exciting that is to read. And I started reading all this disparate information about her told by the men who knew her or knew of her. It's always easy to find information about men of that time if they're men of note. But if it's a woman of note, a woman, you know, no matter what she's done, unless she's queen, unless she's left diaries, journals, or letters, it's almost impossible to find out any information about her. So I had to actually just go about this tangentially and study what men were saying about her and what the times would be like for her. And then I discovered 134 court cases in the Maryland Historical Archives that she presented in front of Leonard Calvert. And I figured if she's standing in front of his court presenting these cases for people that don't have a voice, and even the more wealthy landholder men were hiring her to be their, this is what they said, attorney back then. I thought, wow, no wonder she and Calvert were good friends. Some of this started to make sense. And then the further I dug into these court records that were kind of, they were kind of summarized, I learned who her neighbors were, not so fond fans were, kind of her enemies, who she had problems with, the struggles that were going on in the country at the time. It was a wealth of information. It wasn't her primary source information, but they were court records of the time. And through that and through studying what the situation was like there in Maryland, I made sense out of that inappropriate marriage too. Which I don't think people that are just doing research about pre-colonial Maryland or research about one or two or three of the men or the land records or whatever they're researching, that kind of information isn't going to give them put together puzzle pieces like it happened for me. So I think I uncovered a lot of probable answers that researchers have been struggling with for a long time. At least it made sense to me because the motivations were there.
You had to go really in a roundabout way to research these women's lives.
Yeah, I think if there's no primary source material, it's a real struggle. What I did learn after I wrote the book is that the American Bar Association awards each year to 5 deserving women attorney the Margaret Brandt Award. And it has got this, they know so little about her. It just amazed me. But I think it's because she presented so many cases in the pre-colonial Maryland court. And she was a voice for those that didn't have a voice. And they called her an attorney when the first American certified woman attorney didn't happen until the late 1800s. Annabella Manfield. So that was kind of interesting. They do this every year. And some of the women that they've awarded the Margaret Brent Award to have been Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor and Hillary Clinton. Any woman attorney of note probably has received this Margaret Brent Award. What's interesting is they really don't know who she is. They had that 101 version. It was a very fun thing to write, but it was very demanding.
I bet.
I'm going back to suspense, I think.
Yeah, that's something that's kind of kept me away from historical fiction, is just like the time-consuming nature of doing it justice and really getting an accurate look at something in a time period that we haven't lived in. And there's so much to that. The day-to-day life stuff, the historical timeline, the culture and society of the time, they're just worlds apart from where we are now.
Well, the interesting thing is I suspect you do an awful lot of research anyway for many of your books. And some of your books, you get to build your own culture and worlds, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah.
Which is nice. But with the historical fiction, when you're trying to keep it true to the events and you start researching, it depends upon who the other researchers are. They can really disagree, or someone can hit upon something and everybody will just copy it and not verify it. So it's real tricky.
Yeah, I think that like fact checking and trying to find multiple sources, that adds a lot of time and effort, I'm sure.
It was not nearly as much fun as the first book that I wrote, which grew out of my need to just write this story that was, it was part of the life that I lived, and it was just such a crazy world. I just thought, oh, I just need to tell people about this.
Well, and so with the Flapper series, give me a little rundown of the book so listeners have an idea of what we're talking about.
This first book, The Flapper, The Scientist, and the Saboteur, like I said earlier, I didn't plan on becoming a writer, let alone an author, a published author. But I was working for the public school system. I'd been an educator in elementary and high school, and then I became an administrator. And I couldn't find any place where I think the whole system was absolutely schizophrenic and driving me nuts. And I thought, probably feeling what a lot of women are feeling. And if you have a family or a home to take care of or someone else to take care of, and you've got a full-time job and you're trying to be superwoman, you get to the point where you think you can't handle one more thing. And I was kind of at that point because I was also the community layperson for the Loveless Respiratory Research Institute, which is out on Sandia Laboratory base. You're not allowed in there unless you have been authorized to go in. Mm-hmm. And so I was going out there once, twice a month and reading research protocols with the veterinarian and some of the other researchers. Government had just instituted, because of animal rights and PETA and all that, that research institutes have been really not, well, they've been treating their animals as objects, not as living entities that actually have feelings to some degree, and some of them have strong emotions. And so the government listened and they instituted what they called the IACUC committee, which is the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee. And in order to fully implement that, they had to have someone from the community that was not related to the institution be a part of it, to be an advocate for the animals. And that's what my job was. So I would go out there and I'd read these research protocols and they would say, okay, does anyone have any objection to what this scientist is doing? I had no idea exactly what my position was, but the very first one that I got was a study about rats and alcohol. Just prior to me doing this, a very old aunt that I knew very little about slammed into my life. My mother had died. She'd take care of my mother. And it seemed like I was the only person left to be her caregiver. And I was at that, I can't do one more thing. But I did, and we all do.
Yeah.
So I had this crotchety old aunt that I knew nothing about to speak of, except she'd start smoking when she got up in the morning, and she'd quit smoking just before she fell asleep at night in bed, scary as heck. She'd start drinking at noon, and she would drink way into the evenings. And I'd drag my sorry self home, go in to fix dinner and clean up the house, because she certainly wasn't any neatnik, and I liked an organized house. And there she'd be drinking Cooper Libras, rum and coke, with my husband, and telling him these outrageous stories. Evidently, she had run away from home when she was 16, became a flapper in Chicago during the Al Capone years, and that's what she was talking about. And it was just pretty unbelievable. She never really told many stories about herself, but she told a lot of stories about other people, about names and dates and places. And I started thinking, this is just unreal. So on napkins and envelopes, I started taking little notes. And I had quite a collection of little notes. But at the same time, I'm trying to be a coherent administrator for the Albuquerque Public Schools. And the ACLU had just sued the school district because a 13-year-old had brought a loaded gun on campus. And I had said, no, he can't be on campus. He has to be provided an education off campus where he's not in danger to himself or others. This was just before Columbine. And so the ACLU said I was picking on this little guy. So I ended up being the expert witness for Albuquerque Public Schools for that whole school year. Plus, I had this new volunteer position out at Sandia Labs. And I'm thinking, my life is nuts. How did I get here?
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, I can't handle much more of this. And so I had this protocol of rats and alcohol. And I understand alcohol. And just throw a cigarette in there and we've got it made. You know, just like home. And so they're talking. They said, well, they didn't see any problems with this. And I said, you know, I have one little question. And they said, what's that? And I said, you're going to be infusing these rats with lots and lots of alcohol. I said, so what are you going to do for the hangovers? And they all sat there and looked at me. They looked at each other and said, we hadn't thought of that. That's why you're here. Yes, they will have awful hangovers. So they started talking about painkillers that they could give. I guess that's my job. So yeah. That's when my aunt died. And when I retired, because I never really retire, Houghton Mifflin Publishing asked someone who knew me, I didn't know them, they'd heard me speak, had mentioned to the district manager of Houghton Mifflin Publishing that I would be a good person for their staff, and I didn't know anything about Houghton Mifflin either. I got a phone call, asked if I could come to the Marriott Hotel one afternoon. They wanted to talk to me, and I thought, okay. So I went down there. I had a 15-minute stand-up interview in the lobby before these dignitaries from Houghton Mifflin were to go catch their plane. And they wanted to know if I would go out and present to school districts. And the school district said it had purchased their educational materials. And I said, I'm not a salesperson, but I said, I can sure talk to teachers and administrators. So they hired me on the spot. And the reason why I'm going here is because I spent a lot of time up in Farmington, because Farmington bought a lot of our education materials. And I have a special place in my heart for Farmington. It was just a really, I thought, Farmington? I got up there and I thought, wow, this is really a neat place. I was just impressed with what all they had, their new museum that they built at the time and everything. At this time, my aunt had died and I had retired, and I had a lot of time sitting in hotel rooms. I started writing down my notes, and I thought, you know, I could tell a story about the flapper, but a lot of stories have been told about the flapper, and I don't really know about what she did, because she was pretty private about her own life. However, I know a lot about Biological Science Institute, and a lot of people don't know about that because they never get behind the closed doors and behind the scenes. So what if I took a Biological Science Institute and combined it with this old flapper, not a young flapper, and then put a desperado of some sorts in the Science Institute that did some killing and some sabotage and corporate espionage? How would that work? Well, so that's what I did. I had a heck of a time getting anyone to pick this book up. They said it was two stories in one. They had no idea how to classify it. They didn't know if it was a mystery or if it was mainstream. Or they just didn't want to touch it because nothing like this shown up on the shelves before that they could deal with. And a lot of publishers, they want the next big thing. So they're kind of shy about taking anything that's strange. And my book was strange.
Yeah, I know that problem. I've had that issue with some of my books.
I think it's just pure money issue. They're afraid to lose money. But I think readers are eager for something a little different. My publisher sent this off to Kirkus when they were having a sale, and it came back, and I thought, okay, now what do I do with this? And I had a Kirkus Star, so I went to one of my favorite bookstores, and he says, oh my goodness, you got one of the Kirkus Stars? He said, people would give their right arm to get a Kirkus Star. And I said, well, I don't know what to do with it. And he laughed. He says, you use it for promotion. And I said, I don't even know how to promote. So that's where I was with the first book. But because someone other than my mother said, good job, Charlene, you know, like Kirkus, I thought, well, you know, maybe I can write. And then people started buying my book. And when they were reading it, they said, well, we want to know the story of the flapper when she was a young girl. Okay, I guess I not only have written one book, but now I guess because I've been shown that I can write and people want to read, I guess I have to write the second book. So I just kind of got pushed into this.
That's a fun story of your own personal experiences meshing together in an unexpected way and then transforming into this novel that then the reader expectation was like, okay, we're now tell us the backstory. Like, oh.
And the backstory was, yeah. Okay. I did, and I was glad I did the prequel after I did the main story because it was so much easier to write. And actually, while I was writing the main story, I had to do so much research about Prohibition and Roaring Twenties that I didn't know. I already had half my second book written because that's the era it took place in. So it was just natural to start writing two books at once.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so then the third book in the series, I haven't had the opportunity to read that one yet. How does that tie in with the first two?
Well, I just felt like I left a lot of things unanswered. And my protagonist in the first story, she's so overwhelmed and so stressed out. She's not terribly likable. And she wasn't a very good, attentive wife. And her aunt kept telling her, you know, she needed to relax and live in the moment. And the scientist kept thinking, yeah, you lady, you went out and you partied your whole life. You just don't understand what responsibility's like. So we've got a multi-generation conflict going on all through the whole story. And my protagonist really had a lot to learn. And she hadn't learned it by the end of the first book. So I thought, it's time for her to learn it. And that's why I wrote the last story, The Scientist, The Psychic, and The Nut. And this was really fun for me to write because the old aunt kept telling the protagonist, the scientist, that she needed to take a trip. All she did was work, 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 and clean, clean, clean. And she was obsessive compulsive and she just needed to get relaxed and learn that there's more to life than that. And she's going to take her husband on this Caribbean vacation as she had been instructed to do. And it just turned into a nightmare. The scientist can't leave things alone. She's still obsessive compulsive about everything. She really stirs up a hornet's nest of angry islanders. And she puts herself and her husband in mortal danger throughout the book. And there's an old woman who seems to know an awful lot, which I thought was a fun play because a scientist is black and white. All the facts has to be scientifically explained. And all of a sudden, we're a little bit in woo-woo land. And the scientist is having to stop and question what she believes and what really might be real. And it might not be what she thought. And the nut is not a person. It really is a nut. Well, no, it's not. It's a seed. But it's everybody calls it a nut. Yeah, I'm sure you have this too. Your characters don't behave. And about halfway through the book, they tell me I have the wrong murderer or the characters are not going the right direction. I've got them on the wrong path. This happens, doesn't it? I think it happens to all. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I can fight it and not go anywhere and have a mess, or I can start listening to them. Well, I started listening to them, and for somehow or other, I have no idea how it happened, a little brown nut ended up in the first part of my story. And I thought, what am I supposed to do with this? And this little brown nut goes all the way through to the very last page of the story. It was fascinating to me because I just picked a nut, what I thought was a nut, and I picked the buckeye. And I knew nothing about it, but I know it's a small brown nut with a little tan spot. That'll be neat, something they can slip into their pocket. In the middle of the story, I thought I better look this up. So I started looking up and I thought, not a nut at all. It's a seed.
I did not know that.
Most people don't, but she's a scientist. She better know that.
Yeah, true.
Then after I finished the book, I took it to Taos, to the bookstore up there. I was talking to the manager and she has been such a a blessing to me, my books. They order them left and right up there. She sold so many of my books to the tourists that come through. And she says, "The nut, I read your book." She says, "It's a Buckeye." She says, "You know, my father would never leave the house without a Buckeye in his pocket." I said, "Why?" And she says, "Just because of what you put in your book." She said, "You should know." And I said, "I don't know." I said, "I made that up." She says, "Oh, no." She says, "The Buckeye has strange powers." So I came home and I researched. It turned out there was a casino in Las Vegas that ordered 40,000 of them as an advertising promotional gimmick because they're supposed to bring good luck to people.
Really?
Huh. Yeah, and then my son-in-law said, "Oh, yeah." He says, "I know about that." He says, "My uncle always takes them fishing because he has arthritis. Unless he has it in his pocket, his arthritis is so bad he can't fish."
It is interesting some of those pop up.
Oh, it is. And what's interesting to me is what I find out after I've written the story. I usually find out an awful lot after I've written the story. While I'm writing it, I'm just struggling through it.
Yeah,
but anyway, it was a fun book to write.
Comments from readers, and they pick up on things. And they want to share that with you. You're like, "Huh, all right. I wasn't even aware of that."
I wasn't.
Oh, how fun.
And I don't think my first book doesn't have it, but the second and third book, it's got quirky characters in it. And I just really enjoy finding unusual, strange personalities to work with. And it's just fun. And I bet you do that a lot.
Yeah. Oops. People ask authors a lot what comes from real life and what doesn't. And a lot of it, just like those little moments that you take notice of where you meet a person, you're like, "Oh, that was quite the personality," or "quite the outfit," or just different things you kind of tuck away in your memory that you're like, "Yeah, I'm going to use that one day."
And just kind of capitalize on it, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just, we're great eavesdroppers, aren't we?
Yeah. Good observers.
Yeah, be careful, people.
Yeah.
Observers. Okay, there's a more polite way to say it. I was doing a little research for the young flapper in Chicago when she ran away from home. And she was 16 and she ran away from home from Minneapolis. But this was true about my aunt. She had a college scholarship to, I think it was Stevens in Missouri, which I think is a very prestigious women's college. She scrapped that. She was a senior honor student. And she just ran away. Took the train to Chicago, and that's why I didn't know much about her. My grandparents were embarrassed, and those kinds of things were just horrifying to parents back then. They weren't even allowed to say the word sex or pregnant or anything like that. It was really taboo. And she, I guess, really had quite a life. She was brilliant. She was a voracious reader. She read everything she could get her hands on. But I was looking through some of the old newspapers in 1932 in Chicago and Minneapolis. And I came across one little snippet in the Minneapolis newspaper that said, "Mr. So-and-so was found riding naked on the trolley." Okay.
Good to know.
He was taken into custody and turned over to his family. Okay, but I have no use for that. No use at all for that in my story. I'm not going there. Well, of course, my characters invented a use for it. And all of a sudden, my protagonist, a young high school girl, is talking to an older woman. And the story just gets revealed. And it just gets more convoluted as it goes. I'm thinking, what? I don't want this. I have no place for a naked man riding around on a trolley in my story. Well, evidently I did, because he became the foundation for three of my characters' really bizarre behaviors as adults. I had no conscious reason for that. But subconsciously, I guess my mind was really working overtime. So it was fun.
Kept hold of it and was like, we'll find a place for this somewhere.
I guess so.
How
even
funny.
Though I thought, no, no nuts, no, no naked men on trolleys, no. And there they are.
Well, if that's not something to get people's attention to go check out the book, I don't know what is.
Well, that's funny.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to me about this. I don't think I even really got to my questions. We just had a great conversation about your writing. But yeah, if people want to check it out, the book I was able to read was The Flapper, The Scientist, and The Saboteur. And then the rest of the series sounds wonderful. And I had so much fun reading this book. It was a nice change. I've been doing some nonfiction. And so back to mystery and suspense and some fun, interesting characters. So I enjoyed it a lot. And where can people find you and your books online?
I'm on Facebook. I also have a website. inkydancestudios.com, and they can buy my books at any bookstore. If they don't have it, they can order it, and also from Amazon or any of those places. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for taking the time to come on. This was such a fun conversation. I appreciate it.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.